We'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 36.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, Senate Bill 36A comes to you from the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission. This measure passed the Senate without opposition. This is a measure having to do with subpoenas being carried in a criminal case. It's an efficiency, judicial efficiency issue. The law right now is that a subpoena in a criminal case requires personal service. And what happens oftentimes in criminal cases is they are set over day of trial or shortly before trial. And in cases like that, the prosecutor, defense attorneys, a party who has subpoenaed witnesses to appear has to make a decision about whether or not to personally serve those witnesses again or not. And if they do not personally serve the witnesses again, the validity of those subpoenas is in question. So what this measure would do is to add a new subsection to the statute that deals with criminal court subpoenas that says that a subpoena that has been validly served on a witness in a case where the date for the appearance has changed may be validly carried if the proponent of the subpoena notifies the witness of that change by certified or registered mail. And it also allows another way of validly continuing the subpoena if the witness is present in court and the judge on the record instructs the witness that the date has been carried over and orders the presence of the witness.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Prentice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I think Joe pretty much said it all. This is a this comes from the Criminal Justice Commission, from the governor's. For the record, I'm Craig Prenz, excuse me, executive director of the Criminal Justice Commission. This comes from the governor's public safety review. It's a bill that Judge Legert was going to be here to testify to in support of. In the Senate, we had Mike Dugan on behalf of the DAs and Judge Legert supporting it, and it just is an efficiency bill. As those of you who have been law enforcement officers know, it takes a lot to reserve subpoenas in a criminal case when you have to have the officers, for example, go out and find folks again and reserve them personally, or for defenders to do that with their investigators. And this bill was amended in the Senate to make it clear that if you look at it, really the first part of this, you can continue a subpoena orally. That means when a judge is in court and they have the witness there and it has to be set over, they can just say, this is set over to X date. That's kind of the current practice, and we just want to make sure that that has a good, solid statutory basis. And in the other section that Joe mentioned, to make it clear that this would, all the witnesses would still be getting notice. It would just be through registered or certified mail rather than having, how it would usually work currently would you'd have to have officers go personally serve. So it's just an efficiency bill. It hasn't had any opposition, and if you have any questions, I'd be happy to take a stab at answering them.
Questions?
Just a mechanical question, Mr. Prince. The alternative of sending a mailed notice of a change in the date, I see that it's by certified or registered mail is one alternative, which requires a return receipt, so there would be some proof that the person actually received it. But express mail, I'm not sure that I'm familiar with that use of that as a technical legal term, and it's one that I don't know that it involves a return receipt, so there wouldn't necessarily be any proof of receipt by the witness.
Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, you know, I don't know that that's a technical term either, and as I recall, the idea was that you would still have notice on an express mail. You'd have a signing for it, but other than that, I don't recall why that was put in. I don't think it was on behalf of Joe, I don't remember how that went in, so maybe you can help me out.
Chair Barker, Representative McPherson, my notes indicate that the language that introduced express mail was part of the Dash 2 amendment that was the amendment passed on the Senate side. And if you just give me one more moment, I'll see if I have any notes as to where that came from. My recollection is that Judge Leggett offered the dash two, and I'm seeing help from the gallery, possibly Jean Ann Quinn from the Judicial Department may be able to help us out.
Good morning, Chair Barker. My name is Jean Ann Quinn, and I work for the Oregon Judicial Department. And the amendment actually did come from Judge Leggett and Judge Marcus, and it was to model the language that's currently in other statutes, throughout the code, that provide that the mailing by first class mail would provide that you can get proof of the fact that you've mailed it. And that is in addition then to the proof of registered mail, which is proof that the person received it. And that was the reason it was put in there. And it was to, mirror the other current statutory requirements.
Follow up, if I could. Let me say, to mirror current statutory requirements, so are there is elsewhere in statute where this configuration where it's either by mailing that involves a return receipt or by express mail.
Correct.
And it sounds like would appear to me that just a normal first class mail, you put a 37-cent stamp on it and drop it in the mailbox, that's not good enough. But express mail, is there necessarily, and maybe I understood this from what you said, that there's necessarily some kind of receipt of having turned the piece of mail into the post office for delivery at the front end.
Chair Barker, Representative McPherson, that is correct.
Okay, and that's fine. I have no more questions.
Okay. Further questions? Okay. Thank you.
Give me work session.
That work session.
Mr. Chair, I move that Senate Bill 36 be moved to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Full committee. Any discussion?
Full committee. Yeah, excuse me, to the full committee, sir.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye.
Representative Olson. Excuse me. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 39. Mr. O'Leary.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. Senate Bill 39A comes to you from the Psychiatric Security Review Board. The PSRB is the entity that is in charge of individuals who successfully assert the guilty except for insanity defense. And the measure would do two things. It would require, and both of these issues have to do with an individual who has successfully asserted the GEI defense. Upon the successful assertion of a defense, the court would be required to state affirmatively on the record the mental disease or defect that the court believed established the basis for the guilty except for insanity defense. And it would also require the court, again, after the entry of the GEI verdict, and only if committing the defendant to the jurisdiction of the PSRB, the court would be required to order a psychological or psychiatric evaluation of the defendant, but only if one had not a psychological evaluation had not already been provided to the court. That happens probably, it's estimated, maybe about four, maybe even less times a year. But the problem that is created that this is trying to address is that once a person successfully asserts the GEI defense and they're placed within the board's jurisdiction, the board can only keep jurisdiction of them if they are determined to have a mental disease or defect and determined to be a danger. And what has happened in a handful of cases is once the successful defendant who asserts the GEI goes to the jurisdiction of the board, they may turn around and say, I'm not mentally ill, so you don't have jurisdiction to hold me. This change in the statute will ensure that there is a more detailed record made at the trial court level for the PSRB to rely on once the person is placed within the board's jurisdiction.
Thank you. Ms. Buckley?
Hi. Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Mary Claire Buckley, and I'm the Executive Director of the Psychiatric Review Board, and I don't know that I could have said it any better than Mr. O'Leary. Thank you. We did propose this to the board, looked at the front end of the system and hoped to bring more focus and clarity to that end of the system so that the appropriate persons could be placed under the board, and any concern that individuals who aren't properly placed under the board, given, you know, the extreme growth in our population and the census crisis at the hospital, the board wanted to assure all the stakeholders that only the right individuals are being placed under the board. And so we believe that these two aspects will help in that endeavor.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Close the public hearing, open a work session.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 39A to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Okay. Any discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Representative Barker?
Aye. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 89A. Mr. O'Leary.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, Senate Bill 89A comes to us from the Department of Corrections. It creates two criminal offenses, custodial sexual misconduct in the first degree and custodial sexual misconduct in the second degree. There is an A1 amendment that is in your packet. The two offenses have to do with the prohibition of sexual contact between corrections or probation staff or law enforcement employees and inmates, supervisees, people who are arrested. The Class C felony has to do with sexual contact, that is any form of sexual intercourse or penetration. The Class A misdemeanor has to do with any lesser degree of sexual contact. Under the measure, consent by the arrested person, inmate, whatever you want to call the protected person, is not a defense specifically. There is, however, an affirmative defense in the setting of non-custody, although that's not really the most precise word, but it's a non-institutional setting. So if you have a probation-type supervisor, you can assert an affirmative defense that there was no supervisory or supervisory control over the complaint, but that is the only place that affirmative defense is available. The A1 amendment was actually an amendment that was adopted by the Senate Judiciary Committee on this bill, but because this was early in the session and a relatively inexperienced counsel did not know to combine, I'm pointing to myself for the record, did not know to combine the original amendment and the amendment that is in the form of the A1 together into one. Only one of the amendments made it into the A engrossed version. So the Senate, unfortunately, did not vote on this A1 amendment, and what it would do would be to extend the prohibition to circumstances where a police officer is arresting an individual, and it would prevent either degree of sexual contact between the person employed by the arresting agency and the person who is in custody following the arrest. The measure passed the Senate without opposition.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Sierznak and Mr. Powell.
Chair Barker and members of the House Judiciary Criminal Law Subcommittee, good morning. My name is Stan Zerniak. I'm Assistant Director for Operations for the Oregon Department of Corrections. And Counsel O'Leary, I think, did a good job of covering the particulars of this law. I would like to add that sexual contact between staff and offenders in their control is universally unacceptable. Inmates are dependent on staff for their basic life needs. And because of the inherent power differential, there can truly be no consensual sexual contact between those who supervise and those who are in custody. And it's somewhat analogous to the situation that you have with an adult and a child, where there obviously cannot be any consensual sexual activity between those. The same can be said between inmates and staff. This bill would make, and let me also add, in recognition of that, 48 states have made this type of conduct a felony-type offense. Oregon is one of only two states that has not done that up to this point. The other state is the state of Vermont. This bill would make sexual intercourse between staff, a staff member, or contractor, and a person in custody under their supervision a Class C felony. A conviction would be punishable by a maximum of 5 years imprisonment, a $125,000 fine, or both. Lesser sexual conduct between a staff member, a contractor, and a person in custody or under local supervision would become a Class A misdemeanor. A conviction would be punishable by a maximum of 1 year imprisonment, a $6,250 fine, or both. And I think that, again, Council Larry covered the other points of this bill. And I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
I have just one. Now, would this cover the probation officer or say a guard who visits the spouse of somebody who's in custody?
Chair Barker, are you talking about their own spouse?
No, the guard, if you're the prisoner and I'm the guard and I go see your wife, assuming I'm going to be giving you favors in prison, so would that something like that be covered in this?
Chair Barker, this would only cover those people who are actually in custody.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? Mr. Powell?
Chairman, members of the committee, my name is John Powell, representing the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. We support Senate Bill 89 and, in particular, the amendments that are being offered. The definition of correctional facility would include a county facility, and it is the very ardent and strong position of the Sheriff's Association that this kind of conduct should not be tolerated and should be illegal. We may be back next session to strengthen it beyond the arrest situation to allow any kind of detention situation whereby an officer detains someone without making a formal arrest but coerces this individual into sexual activity. So we do support this bill and the amendments. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? And Mr. Cerniak, I want to thank you for the work you've done on this, and Mr. Williams for getting this, bringing this law forward. I really appreciate that effort.
Thank you, Chair Barker. Appreciate it.
Ms. Quintero, I probably mispronounced that again, but I'm getting close.
Chair Barker and members of the committee, my name is Terry Quintetos, and I'm the Program Director for Crime Survivors for Community Safety. This bill's already been gone over in pretty good detail. I would just like to go on the record that Crime Survivors for Community Safety strongly supports this particular bill and believes that it is a very good idea.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? Thank you very much, and thank you for your written testimony on that. Close public hearing and open a work session.
Well, Mr. Chair, I move that Senate Bill 89 be moved to the committee with a due pass recommendation, full committee.
We need to put the
I think there's some amendments, although I have to say I didn't quite follow. There was some reference to dash one amendments, and I see an A3 is here.
Chair Barker, Representative McPherson, I misled you if I said the A1. I was relying on my notes. I assumed it would be an A1, but it is the A3 amendment that adds the immediately following arrest, and it also adds the worker on the job training pursuant to ORS 421354, which is a reference to the Oregon Corrections Enterprise. That's the semi-independent agency that operates within the Department of Corrections doing work projects with inmates.
Okay, then, Mr. Chair, I would make a motion then to move the dash three amendments into House or Senate Bill 89.
Are there any objections? Hearing none, so ordered.
And then I would move also that Senate Bill 89, as amended, be moved to the committee, full committee, with the due pass recommendation.
Okay. Any discussion? Senator Wilson?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye.
Okay. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 114. Mr. O'Leary.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. Senate Bill 114 comes to us from the Department of Transportation. This has to do with the screening fee for an assessment for an individual who has been convicted of driving under the influence of intoxicants, or for an individual who is entering a diversion program for driving under the influence of intoxicants. The individual in either case is responsible currently to pay a fee of $90 for the initial assessment to determine what level of treatment is appropriate. That fee was last raised in 1989, and this bill would increase the fee that the individual must pay for the assessment to $150.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Douglas.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Committee members, my name is Teresa Douglas. I'm a member of the Governor's Advisory Committee on DUII. I'm also an alcohol and drug evaluation specialist and have been working in that capacity since 1984. I'm speaking to you today regarding Senate Bill 114, which increases the fee from $90 to $150. Evaluation specialists provide a lot of services to the courts, to the clients, to the treatment programs. Our function is not just a screening function. We do the initial screening. We refer them to a treatment program. We monitor their compliance. We report back to courts as to their compliance with their diversion. On the convictions, we do the screening and refer them to treatment, and it used to be that we didn't have to monitor their compliance. In 2001, the administrative rules were changed that now require us to do that. So we do now track the convictions as well. As was stated before, this fee was last increased in 1989. The cost of providing these services has definitely increased since then, and the fee of $90 no longer covers the cost of providing these services. Also, because of budget cuts in the courts, we're finding that we're taking on a lot of the work of reporting and helping the courts monitor these clients. So because of our knowledge of alcohol and drug and the administrative rules and how the DUII system works overall, we're kind of the center spoke in the system. We connect the treatment program, the client, the court, and make sure that the treatment is done and done according to administrative rules. Since this fee would have no effect on any state or county budget because the client pays us directly for our services, we would ask that this be passed with a due pass recommendation. And with that, I'll conclude my testimony and take any questions.
Okay, any questions?
I just have a little question here about, I'm just trying to understand, you're with the Governor's Advisory Committee on DUII. Is it the advisory committee that provides these evaluation services? I'm trying to figure out where the services come from.
We are certified by the State Office of Mental Health, and then we are designated by each court to provide that service. So some of us are private providers. There's very few left that are county-run evaluation services. Most of us are private now.
I see. Okay.
That group has a seat on the governor's task
force. I see. Okay. I'm just trying to get the connection here. Thank you.
No further questions. Thank you very much. Close the public hearing and open the work session.
I just have a comment. I think we are the most feed-to-death state in the whole union, but, you know, on this I have no problem raising the fee.
It is. It has been 15 years, and everybody knows everything's gone up over that time. And,
these people need to be paying their own freight, pickup drivers.
I move Senate Bill 114 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Any discussion? Call the roll, please.
Senator McPherson?
Aye.
Senator Bolton?
Aye.
Senator Thatcher?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye. And Representative Thatcher. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 203. Mr. O'Leary.
Thank you, Chair Barker. Members of the committee, Senate Bill 203 comes to us from the Department of Justice. This is a measure that has to do with the statute of limitations for certain sex offenses and certain child abuse offenses. There are, you may recall, because the committee has heard testimony about this statute in another context earlier this session, but there is a statute that prescribes three alternative time limits for prosecution of certain felonies and certain misdemeanors that have to do with sexual offenses against children. One of the alternatives that applies to this bill is the alternative that says that a prosecution can be commenced within 6 years for a felony or 4 years for a misdemeanor after the offense is reported to a law enforcement agency or other governmental agency. This bill would amend that language, the reported to law enforcement or other governmental agency. It would delete the language about other governmental agencies and replace it with the Department of Human Services. The bill is in response to a case out of the Court of Appeals in 2004, State versus Walker, in which the court, after a very thorough review of the statute and the legislative history of the statute, determined that other governmental agency meant it included a public school teacher. So in that case, in the State v. Walker case, the court held the statute of limitations for this child, for that particular child sex abuse offense, began to run after the complaining witness disclosed the alleged abuse to a public school teacher. And for that reason, if my recollection is correct, the prosecution was determined to be barred and the conviction was reversed. So what this bill would do is to change that other governmental agency to make clear that the statute begins to run not from the point where the complainant reports to a school teacher or a legislator, pick any other fill-in-the-blank governmental employee, but to law enforcement or the Department of Human Services, which are the two agencies that I believe the sponsors of the bill feel are appropriately responsible for investigating these sorts of allegations.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Fessner.
Good morning, Chair Barker and members of the committee. My name is Jonathan Fussner. I am an Assistant Attorney General in the Oregon Department of Justice. I'm here on behalf of Senate Bill 203. This bill is, as Mr. O'Leary has just told you, designed to clarify the meaning of the term other governmental agency in our child sex crime statutes of limitation. The problem is that term has not been defined in the statutes, and consequently we ended up with this court opinion in State versus Walker that gave that term a very broad reading. It would cover any person who works for the government in any capacity who happens to also be a mandatory reporter of sex crimes or child abuse under the mandatory reporter statute. And so you can have a janitor in a school, you can have a all sorts of people who may be a government employee, but their job and their authority does not include investigating the crime itself. And we think it is appropriate to limit the trigger for this statute of limitations to the moment when the crime is reported to law enforcement or to DHS, those being the two government entities that have the power and the duty to actually take action on the report. And thereby we hope to eliminate cases like State versus Walker, where a report is made, no one follows up on it, but because the report was made, the statute started running, and ultimately the person responsible for this crime walks because the prosecution wasn't commenced within a statute of limitations that essentially nobody knew was running at that time. I would be happy to try to answer any questions you may have.
Questions? Thank you, Mr.
President. Thank you.
Close the public hearing and move to a work session.
Mr. Chair, I move that Senate Bill 203 be moved to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Any discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Holton?
Aye.
Representative Thacker?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye. And Representative McPherson, carry that. Any further business before our committee today? Adjourned.